Welcome to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast with founders Stan Campbell and Mike Darter. If you're forced to fight the battle for your life, CCW Safe will fight the battle for your future.
All right, welcome back to the Inside CCW Safe Podcast. I'm Mike Darter in Oklahoma City.
Stan Campbell, I'm still in Vegas, so just hanging out here.
And we have, once again, Steve Moses in Oklahoma City.
Steve, hello, guys. How you doing? I'm great, guys. How are y'all?
Great, man. Great to have you back. Last podcast was great. Steve is an author, writes articles on our site. He's written for magazines. What all magazines have you written for in the past?
I've got articles in American Handgunner Journal. I've got quite a few articles. I actually have two articles in the current issue of SWAT magazine.
Nice.
One on the Red Zone Threat Management Empty Hand Knife Defense System, and one on the Wilder Tactical Belt System. But those are in the current issues of SWAT magazine.
Nice. So get that. Sweet. And if you haven't listened to the last podcast, listen to it. Kind of ran through his bio again last podcast, but he's been writing for us for some time now. He's got some great content. Immediately when he started putting out his articles, we started getting great feedback on it. If you can pull those up, if you're new to CCW Safe, you can pull those up by going to our news section, and you can go back as far as you can. There's a search function. But he's got some great articles on there and going to continue to have some great articles on there. He's also doing some stuff with FTA. So, Steve, you're going to probably be hearing a lot from Steve in 2019, both on the website and in some podcasts and some other stuff. So, today, last week, we talked about the New Year's resolutions. Again, those articles are online. Had a good talk, and we kind of got into a little bit of the gear, guns and gear. Today, we're going to really talk more about that.
That is correct.
In depth, because a lot of people, and if you're new to concealed carry, or if you've carried for 10 years, there's always new gear coming out. There's always new technologies. There's all this new stuff. So we're going to get right into it. Stan, do you have anything to talk about first? We don't need to do a weather report. It's just cold everywhere. We normally do a weather report, but that's when Stan's in L.A. because we're all jealous of Stan because he's got the good weather out there.
Yeah, I'm waiting on that big earthquake, but no tornadoes, no dust storm, no ice storms.
We probably have more earthquakes here in Oklahoma than you have now.
Yeah, you really have. I felt two there. I've never felt any in California, but I felt two in Oklahoma City.
You've never felt any there? Crazy, no, not man. At all.
But anyway, enough about the weather. I'm really excited about, hearing Steve's perspective on gear, because I know there was, several different explosions in the industry in reference to, a lot of gear coming out, changes in the industry, and he's much more of a gun nut than I will ever be, so let's get into it.
I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Before we get into that, too, I wanted to bring up a couple things. So when this airs, this is going to be right after SHOT Show. So Steve is actually going to be going out to SHOT Show, and we're going to be should be probably reporting on stuff. So look in the future for things to come out from SHOT Show. Also, one of the things I wanted to ask Steve about was I've talked to actually more than maybe two or three people have this conversation has come up, but I know there's a lot of people who are kind of thinking that the state of training and in the gun industry, firearms industry over the last, let's say, 10 to 20 years has been real heavy tactical, a lot of carbine training. I've heard several people talk about how they think that they're going to see a transition to more, I don't know what you call, more concealed carry?
Practical.
More practical. So do you think that as well?
I very much do so. Uh-huh. Again, when this first all started happening, There were just kind of a few, there was kind of a small subset of people that were into the tactical training. It was a relatively small percentage of our population. And I watched it go through a trend where it first started out with handguns, and then the next trend was with shotguns, both with buckshot and slugs. Usually shotguns were equipped with ghost ring sights. And then it went ahead and went into the carbines as the AR-15 system became more popular. Back then, they were still considered by many with some, you know, suspect plastic guns, you know, poodle shooters, etc. But then people realized that the carbine had a number of attributes when it actually came to law enforcement, especially when doing forced entries. And they were going, why are they taking rifles into apartments and houses? Well, these were still, you know, short distance confrontations. And the reason was because the rifle was so much more effective in stopping a threat as quickly as possible, more so than the handgun. Well, then that created a great trend in carbine training and tactical training. Yeah. We started seeing some former military instructors offering carbine classes. I mean, I took all of them. I took a bunch of them.
Yeah.
It's still a cool gun. But the reality of it is that in no way is a carbine an everyday carry weapon. As a matter of fact, if you carry it around, here comes the man with the gun call. There's very few opportunities to use a carbine. A carbine, I think, is ideal for home defense under certain circumstances. You know, Stan may have some thoughts on this. Civil insurrection, we've seen in lootings, you know, like in New Orleans and Houston and other areas, where having a carbine often meant you had the means to protect your house more effectively than with a handgun. But the reality of it is that really what we're talking about is going to be, you know, confrontations with people, mostly in transition areas where you can't have a carbine. And so then it kind of came back down to the practical use of handguns. And people started to realize that much of the handgun training, and which we were seeing, the square range training, you know, the law enforcement academy, you're shooting paper targets and, you know, 3 to 25 yards and everything. That wasn't really real life. That's not the way things were going down. So some instructors recognized that. We were seeing that trend 15 years ago. And now it's come down to where it's much more practical, which for me is a plus, because now I can actually see some of the things that I train being used in the street, as opposed to, you know, my standing, you know, at an indoor range with a paper target. The guy's got a, you know, a ski mask on, which you almost never see in the street, you know, and a handgun down at belly level. And so I think we're seeing a much more trend towards the practical application of handguns and support tools.
Cool. Stan, you got anything you want to add on that?
No, you know, I kind of agree with him. And, you know, the thing about those type weapons, you know, the intimidation factor is really what kind of played in played as an advantage, you know, to having something like that back in those days and for riots and different things like that. So that's kind of what that was for initially. But go ahead.
Back in those days.
Back in those days, before me.
It was a much different law enforcement world.
Oh, yes, it was.
So yes, we're going to talk about today. We kind of started, we talked a little bit in the New Year's resolutions about getting your gear under control and get it. So let's just start there. We talked about for firearms recommending what CCW Safe used to recommend and still do, really, but it was finding determining, you know, what law enforcement uses in your area, and the reason for that is that they were vetted and tested, and not only just the firearms but the ammunition. We talked a little bit about it. Your go-to is Glock 19.
Glock 19.
Glock 19. Or do you see any other, you know, SIGs come on pretty heavy lately. I've got the P365, which I like. I've got the Glock 43, which I like as well. I like the feel of the SIG. I never have been, you know, I've always been a Glock guy while I was on the street and and as an officer, but I really like that feel. Do you see any other on the when talking about actual firearms with you know, for I think, you know, you see a lot in the past, you've had people say, well, you know, if you have a wife, she needs this type of gun or whatever. And I think the biggest thing is what you had said is just whatever you feel comfortable with.
You need a durable gun, a reliable gun. It's hard, in my opinion, to go wrong with a polymer frame striker-fired pistol. Mm-hmm. The Glock was kind of the first on the bandwagon. The Smith & Wesson M&P 2.0 is a good gun. CZ has a good version of the gun. SIG has a good version of the gun. These are relatively simple guns, and if you adhere to the principles of firearm safety, and that is, you know, you assume all guns are always loaded. You never let point the sights at anything you're not willing to shoot or destroy. You keep your finger off the trigger until your sights are up on the target. You know what you know your target. You know what's behind it, what's in front of it, what's around it. One gun is typically, in my opinion, if handled in that manner, just as safe as another gun.
Yeah.
You know, some guns come with mechanical safeties, and while that is an extra added, you know, step in terms of maybe preventing a negligent discharge, it's still a mechanical device. Mechanical devices do fail, and in some circumstances, a failure to engage a mechanical device is a problem. I've seen multiple shooters when shooting the hammer-fired SIGs fail to decock the gun prior to putting that back in their holster, which is, you know, that's very dangerous. Same is true for the 1911 frame guns and everything. So without, you know, really, you know, beating a dead horse, something along the lines of what we spoke are fine. There is a lot of interest in the Langdon version of the Beretta 92s, and those are actually very fine guns. Same thing is there are some really nice 1911s out there. You know, Wilson makes some, there's some quality 1911s. If a person is interested, though, in using something other than a polymer frame striker-fired pistol, they've got some additional manual of arms that they need to understand, which can include decocking, engaging of safeties. With certain Berettas, I believe you actually could decock it, and then it would still be on safe. And so then you would have to disengage the safety, which the thumb had to go forward in order to do that. And so there's a certain complexity to there that unless you're willing to commit yourself to that, you know, you're really a gun person. Those are typically tools that I would avoid. And I just, again, just, you know, basically a handgun is a tool. You know, it's not a magic talisman. It's not going to get you out of anything. I think we spoke in maybe that recent podcast that in the force-on-force, you know, scenarios that we've done at the exact moment that we were engaging another person or persons, the exact gun that we were holding in our hand, the sights and the trigger, didn't really seem to matter so much as dealing with the situation.
So, what sights?
Yeah, that's just that's my thoughts on that. Would you agree, Stan?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, as you go into that too, because you're actually speaking to a wide variety of customers and listeners and carriers. Like when you say things like decock and different things like that, can you kind of, you know, give a short definition of those things when you
absolutely kind
of brush through them?
Sure. With certain guns, they refer to them as double action / single action. The gun is carried, or the handgun is carried, with the hammer down. When the pistol is presented and the shooter intends to engage the target, the shooter will then press the finger on the trigger, and they'll go through a long trigger pull, which actually cocks the hammer. The first shot, when fired, dependent upon the gun, may take anywhere from 8 to 14 pounds of pressure in order to fire that first round. When the slide reciprocates, it actually leaves the hammer in a cocked mode, so the second round is going to take far less pressure, maybe anywhere from 3 to 5 pounds. Right. So your first trigger pull could be 7 to 14, and your second and subsequent trigger pulls could be 3 to 5 to 7. Well, in order to make that handgun safer, not entirely safe, but safer, it's necessary to decock the hammer. With certain guns, like the older CZs, you actually had to manually decock, which would mean that you would grab the hammer and then press the trigger and slowly lower the hammer.
That's right.
And then with the more modern ones, they would have a decocker lever, which you could actually depress the lever, which would then cause the hammer to fall forward. It'd fall forward safely. The Beretta 92 does this, as does the, you know, the SIG hammer-fired versions. And so that disengaged it, and that put that hammer, or that put that hammer down. So again, it would cause anywhere from, you know, 7 to 14 pounds of trigger pull, long trigger pull, in order to fire the handgun. If they failed to decock it, and they went ahead and they holstered that pistol, okay, the pistol is not unsafe. It has no other passive safeties, and that if you actually catch the trigger on perhaps some gear, especially like if you're a police officer and you're wearing, you know, web gear, tactical vest, ballistic armor, whatever, or maybe even a holster that's a leather holster that has a tendency to collapse, it could engage that safety and cause the gun to fire while being placed in the holster. And when that gun fires while in the holster, the results can be pretty catastrophic. It's not uncommon for shooters to shoot themselves in their own offhand, shoot themselves in the leg, shoot themselves in the hip. So that would be the decock. The 1911s were actually they were designed to be carried with the hammer cocked, but a manual safety, thumb safety engaged. And most of them also had a grip safety. And so what you would do is when you presented the handgun, you would manually disengage the safety, you would fire the weapon, and when you were ready to put it back in the holster, you would re-engage the safety and then put it back in the holster. Failure to re-engage the safety kind of subjects you to, you know, the same you know, results that might happen with a pistol that was not decocked, that was double action, single action.
And I don't care what anybody says, but when that gun goes off unintended, it's never good.
Yeah, that is. That's a very loud noise.
It's never good.
That's a very surprising noise.
You know, there's a lot of people that, and this is probably a totally different discussion, I don't even know if I should go here, but there's a lot of people that think that that double action, single action is a, that first long trigger pull is important to keep people out of bad decisions. I don't know if I, you know, I carried a, and I still do some, but not as much often, but a Smith Shield 9, which is a great gun. I love it, but it does have that, it does have the, now you can get them without the safety.
Right.
But I just didn't like that safety just because I've never had a safety. And I just, it never was something that I was used to. And it's something that else you have to train to do that.
You have to train. You have to train.
So
you have to be. Go ahead, Stan.
No, I was going to say, hey, this is also off topic, but I think it's really important because we receive about probably 10 calls a week from our members in reference to modifying the trigger and placing a lighter trigger on there. What's your opinion on that? Because we have an opinion, but I want to know yours.
Well, my opinion is that I probably do not have an issue with a modification to the trigger that perhaps removes creep, which means mm-hmm. when I'm taking the slack out of a polymer-framed striker-fired pistol, sometimes you'll feel this creep where you can feel the trigger hit
a wall, like the wall?
Or? Well, no, it's prior to the wall.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so you feel like a creep, and you think, okay, I've got the wall.
Oh,
you haven't
not
hit
the wall.
Wall,
yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So anything, if your trigger has excessive creep in there, I don't mm-hmm. have a problem with a modification that eliminates that creep, but I prefer to keep the actual trigger weight required to, you know, cause that gun to fire the same as factory. Mm-hmm. And so I very seldom nowadays, the Glock that I'm carrying right now, as a matter of fact, all my Glocks now have stock triggers on them. And yep. I, you know, a lot of people will go and put a 3.5-pound connector mm-hmm. on it and everything.
Yeah.
And I'm like going, well, I tell you what, my only concern about that is that, and I think actually, you know what, this is cool. Actually, wrote an article on this called "Don't Teach Your Students How to Outrun Their Headlights." And
yeah.
one of the things is,
I like that.
It's on. There's a trend now to teaching our students how to shoot guns very, very fast.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll see people shooting for that magical 0.2 or 0.25 second splits. And what I mean is, firing aimed rounds, that's one round being able to be fired accurately every 2/10 to 1/4 of a second. And so what happens is that in order to do that, when you fire the gun while the sights are rising, you have to reset the trigger and be ready to fire the gun again whenever those sights settle. That's what you have to do. And if you have a light trigger, then the possibility that your gun may fire again while you're simply resetting the trigger with no yeah. intention to fire another round, I think the chances are increased. Mm-hmm. And I really want to do everything I can to, you know, if I have to use my gun in self-defense, I want to have had the actual intent to, you know, fire every shot that came out of that gun versus one that, okay, well, that was an accident.
Mm-hmm.
So I am not a fan of reducing the trigger weight to any less than factory, but as far as some of the, you know, the modern triggers that just kind of clean that up or shorten the reset a little bit, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, and that's also why, you know, many instructors, if not the majority, you know, tell you to keep your finger off the trigger, you know,
yes.
run it across the guard and, you know, until you actually acquire a target and are ready to engage, correct?
That is correct. And again, that trend towards speed shooting and quickly resetting the trigger, while I think that's really good because it gets you back in position to shoot again, especially if you need to. But if you start monkeying with that trigger, the chances of negligent discharge, in my opinions, go up.
Yeah,
and some of them are pretty fast that I've shot.
You're not lying. They're really quick.
Yes.
Hey, Steve. Also, I wanted to know now. What is your primary carry for concealed carry, or what's your top five? How many do you actually exchange?
Well, I tell you what. This is going to sound so boring. My top four are all Glock 19s that I own because I have four Glock 19s.
Okay.
I was fortunate enough to get two of the Vickers models. I've got one in sniper gray and one in black, and those are like my babies. And one is just a complete safe queen. You know, I'll bequeath that to my grandson someday. But I have two Gen 5 Glock 19s, and that is what I run. Stan, I hate to say this. I am a one-trick pony. It's very difficult for me to go from pistol to pistol to pistol and shoot all of them at the same level of competence and with confidence.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of like, okay, I kind of stick with one platform, and then I have a Glock 43 that I it's similar very much so to my Glock 19, just, you know, sort of miniaturized.
Mm.
And I like it because it's still a Glock platform. I understand that. And that's what I carry on those days when, okay, I'm going to, you know, wear a T-shirt and shorts.
Mm-hmm.
Or I really want to go just super low profile. Or I had mentioned before that when I have children in my house, I typically, I'm not one of those persons that's real comfortable leaving firearms around the house staged in the event of a home intrusion. But I'm very much aware that home intrusions do happen. You know, I've been in there one time. And so I wanted to have access to a gun. And with a Glock 43 or like the SIG 365, something like that, the shield, my wife has a shield, I can actually put that in a pocket holster and drop that in my, you know, in my shorts, in the front pocket of my shorts or my pants or whatever I'm wearing. And so those are primarily my preferred tools.
Yeah, awesome.
You know, I really like the I've always been a Glock guy. I'm Glock 19. I carried Glock 21 on duty, and that's what my shooting is with. I carry Glock 19 now. I've got all the Vickers. I don't have the black, so I've got the gray. I've got the
mine's not for sale.
dang it! I thought I was going to give it out. Got the flat darker, the one with the black slide. Another one. I didn't get the black, and that's one I really wished I would have gotten. And now he has the Gen 5. Yeah. That's done with Wilson Combat. That is awesome.
Really?
Oh yeah, it looks awesome. Didn't you get one, Stan? Or do we have it at the? I think we may have it at the office for you.
I believe Kyle may have.
Yeah, it's at the office, and I've
well, I guess I do have a black one now, don't I?
Oh yeah, you do. Don't touch gun, Michael.
But the P365 I really like. Now on the black on my, I've got a Gen 5, just regular one. Nice. I did, but I put a thin blue line Apex thin blue line trigger in it. It's just flat trigger. It's not, it doesn't adjust the weight, but it's just a smoother trigger. And that's through Apex. And then in my 365, I just carry it plain. But I really like how modular that 365 is. I got a Gray Guns lower. Frame for it, and I couldn't. I was like, "How do? What is this? You know, trying to get that front pin off of the front of the trigger mechanism housing, but it's all one. It just one pin pulls it out, and that kind of surprised me. I really like how easy that was to pull out, and it's just the trigger mechanism inside. In Glock, is you remove the pin from the back and the pin from the front. On the P365, it's just one pin on the back and the whole thing pulls out. But I just like simple.
Right.
And reliable. I mean, Glocks have always been that in my experience. I think SIG's really come on strong with the P320 and the 365, which I like. But, they had problems.
Yes, they do. Stan, in response to your question, which I think you may have asked me, what were my top five? I do a lot of instruction, and I, participate in pistol matches. So I have the ability to just see hundreds of thousands of rounds go down every single year. I think that M&P 2.0, the new improved version, is really a nice gun. For concealed carry, I got my wife a M&P Shield, and we like it. It's very shootable. The SIG 320s are coming on real strong. And so there's some good guns out there. I've seen some of that, the CZ striker-fired pistol. Those are all good guns. I know there's other versions. I know that there's Canics and Berettas out there. I don't have a real strong opinion on them, just mostly because I haven't seen that many.
Yeah.
But any of those guns are good guns. And, hey, if I could just add a few mods I do make to my guns if necessary, is I change out my sights as necessary in order to make them more visible.
Yeah.
And so right now I'm, running a Mariglow. I've got like the cap sights one of them and the hack sights on the others. And I find that's a big help to me, in kind of low light areas. And the other thing I do is I will modify the frame of my Glocks if I think it helps me in some way. So on some of the older Glocks that didn't really have the very rough finished textures, I'm not adverse to some of this, the stippling that you see in order to, improve the ability to grip that gun and maintain control of it. And I also will have a gunsmith go in there and I'll have him do just a little bit of an undercut on the trigger guard so that I don't get the dreaded Glock knuckle from, you know, getting that big callus on my knuckle. It allows me to get my gun up a little bit handy, you know, higher. But other than that, any modifications I do to them are just pretty much non-existent.
Yeah, and just to let the listeners know, you know, I asked that question, you know, of Steve because I want to know from a trainer's perspective. But please do know that, you know, although, you know, a prosecutor, DA might be looking for, you know, any reason to demonize you or make it seem that, you know, you were looking for a gunfight, you know, modifications, if they do come up, you know, we absolutely still, you know, cover you guys and we just put experts against experts just to make it a non-issue.
So, no reason to make it hard on yourself, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you have more of a problem by what you post on your Facebook and Twitter than what you would, you know, modifying a trigger.
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes when I see what people post, I'm like, ugh, I'm horrified. That's going to be out there forever.
Yeah.
I hope that does not come back to haunt you someday. And so if that's something that maybe some of our listeners have been doing, well, now's a good time to, you know, not do that.
To really think about it.
Sometimes, you know, God, I'm going off on the weeds again. I have such a trend. I tell people, if you said something that is you believe that was controversial at one time, it's never too late to come back and walk it back. And say, you know, I said this so many years ago, and that was a mistake, and I wish to retract that. I don't think it hurts to do that.
I wish to retract that.
Yeah. You can't unsay it.
No, but you can say,
I retract
and
that.
And actually, we have a good article that I'm going to put in the show notes. Remember that Sean Vincent wrote on steps to do if you're involved in relation to social media. It was on last year sometime. We'll put that on because it's very important.
Awesome. Hey, and back on your other thing about, because you said something about low light shooting. You know, I too think it's important to find a range that will, you know, allow you some time as well, or have an area in which they allow you to do some low light shooting because, you know, primarily, you know, when you get attacked or it's just been, you know, what you can research, you'll find that a lot of it happens under the cover of darkness. So, you know, just like Steve said, you know, modify your sights so that you can actually see and actually practice as well. Wouldn't you agree, Steve?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I'll sometimes go into my garage and I'll just be able to barely see my sights. And I go ahead and I practice anyway. What I don't want to do is put myself into a position where all of a sudden I'm like, oh, where's my sights? I can't find my sights. If you're accustomed to, okay, basically, you know, practicing in low light scenarios, because basically here's all your sights do. All your sights do is verify that your muzzle is aligned with the target. So basically it's just making sure you have a good index. At most of the distances at which we will probably have to use our handguns to defend our lives, probably you may not even be able to see your sights at that distance. But that doesn't mean that you don't go ahead and attempt to use your sights, which just verifies nothing more than basically your index was correct. So I'm a big advocate of that. One of the things that I kind of get on some of my students is the competitors that go and they shoot all the time with these glasses that basically have the magnification like a bifocal in the top as opposed to the bottom. That on the range, they can see their front sight very, very sharply. But that's only when they're shooting, you know, their gun with those particular glasses.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, my concern has always been is, well, you're not training like you're going to fight, you know. So if you think that, okay, all of a sudden, you know, some guy's out there at 15 yards and you've trained this way to where you can always see your sights and then you can't, that's not good. That's not good. You need to kind of know what your limitations are and what you, you know, you can and you can't do. One of the other things that I am a believer of in that when you're outside your house, there is probably not a great need to have a weapon-mounted light. And the reason for that is that there has to be enough light for the person that would be assaulting you to observe you also. And so Tom Gibbons, you know, I've thrown his name out so much, I'm such a name dropper. Fantastic instructor, instructor, mentor of mine. I train under Tom every year. He's maintained a database of his students that have been in shootings. He owned Rangemaster. Tom's probably trained 25,000 students by now. He maintained a database of every shooting that he's aware of. He knows of 66. I may have mentioned this earlier. Three of the 66 did not survive. The reasons for sure that they didn't survive, we at least know, was all three of those failed to bring their handgun with them that particular day.
Oh, wow.
In the other 63, all 63 of his students prevailed. Several were shot. One was injured, you know, severely. But, you know, I mean, I'm not saying he doesn't have some, you know, some damage from that day, but he recovered and that particular person is having a good life. All of his other students successfully prevailed in those 63 shootings. Most of them were in low light circumstances, and in none of those shootings, a weapon mounted light would have probably made any difference on the outcome.
And we were talking about that earlier. I was asking you because a lot of the smaller, guns, like the Shield or the Glock 43, P365, don't have the rails. And even some of the older Glocks don't. 19s don't have rails. That they now do that you can put lights on. Now they do have the aftermarket, you know, frames and stuff. But I was talking to you about that for the, I think it's the Foxtrot is the new one out for the P365 versus just carrying a pin light, which is, what do you have there?
This is a Streamlight. It's a ProTec 2AA. It's a little 200, that runs on 2AA batteries, and it's 250 lumens, which compared to the old Mag. Cell, 4D cell mag lights that, you know, you can barely see where the dog is in the backyard with. I mean, these things are just fantastic. I believe that handheld light is more important than a weapon-mounted light, and I believe that a weapon-mounted light at home is fantastic.
Yeah.
Because I believe that in your home, having a light on that weapon allows you to deal with the situation where, okay, I have got this child scooped up, or I'm holding this guy at gunpoint, and now I need to call 911, and okay, what am I going to do with my, I've got a gun, a light, and a phone, and I've got two hands.
Yeah.
So the weapon-mounted light does two things. One is that it allows you to free up a hand to use a phone or scoop up someone else. And the other thing is, if you get into an actual shooting scenario, it allows you to get two hands on the gun, supported fire, which allows you to shoot, in my opinion, more accurately and quicker and more effectively. So I think it's very important. And at home, at night, I have a weapon mounted, I have a weapon light.
Do you have a Streamlight?
I have a Streamlight. When I was on the team, I used a Surefire. Surefire probably has the most, robust, bulletproof equipment. And, we were hard on that equipment and training. We were hard on that while doing dynamic entries. We did dynamic entries. I mean, we went in there, we went pistol, rifle, rifle. And we all had weapon-mounted lights. And, especially we were the guys, if you were free, you were more likely to be the guys that would go over there and grab someone and put them on the ground. And so I thought that was very important. But I don't think that it's necessary for someone that's, carrying a handgun for their protection out in public. But I'm a big advocate of also having a flashlight on your person, on having one on your nightstand, and having one on your vehicle. And I think we, discussed that when we referenced to that one person that probably wouldn't be where he was today had he had a light, just a handheld light in his vehicle, and he could have identified this intoxicated person, which he didn't really know that at the time. He said, I believe I understood him to say he thought he was going for a handgun possibly in his pocket when he engaged him. Well, you could, that gave you the ability to light him up. And so I'm a huge advocate of handheld lights, you know, for multiple reasons. And the other one is that with a handheld light for clearing my house, I just think it's so far superior to a weapon-mounted light. It means I do not have to point my muzzle of my gun at something that I just wish to illuminate, I just wish to see, I just wish to identify. The other thing is, it's kind of a it attracts attention. And the other thing is, it's a bullet magnet. I did a I did three classes called Arm Movement Structure, done by taught by Craig Douglas, and Craig is just everybody needs to train under Craig Douglas. Craig is just
I've seen some of his.
He's just phenomenal. Matter of fact, I wrote an article on the class, well, actually, I took the class three times, then I wrote an article on it that was in a 2012 issue of SWAT magazine called, you know, A Real Estate Guide for Defensive Shooters. And it was about arm movement and structures. And so I took this 20-hour class three different times, and what Craig taught and we put to use was the use of a handheld flashlight held away from our body. We use that to identify threat areas, threat area being someplace where there might actually be a threat. We use that in order to, you know, they say momentarily blind the, you know, the contact. You don't really momentarily blind them, but they cannot see where your location is. And you can also use it to actually mask where your location is by holding it away from your head. You can use it in such a manner to cross threat areas in the open using speed because you're out in the open. You don't want to stay exposed. You can actually use it, especially if it has a strobe feature, to even mask the direction in which you're moving. It has all of these wonderful features. It's just a great tactical tool when employed correctly. And the other thing that I think I may have referenced is that most of the flashlight technique I see in movies and television is just so wrong. You know, it's done for cinematic purposes. When I was a still relatively young police officer, my partner and I, we were serving writs, and we came to an apartment in which we need to, you know, serve a writ. And the apartment had been burgled and the door kicked in. And so under those circumstances, you know, we called in and we cleared that house using handheld lights. And I tried using my handheld light. And do you remember the Harry's technique, Stan, where you basically kind of mate your hands together, back of the hand to back of the hand? You hold the flashlight forward. I did that clearing the house. And by gosh, I found myself in a bind from time to time because I wasn't able to go a full 180 just the way my body's constructed. I was like, oh, my gosh. You know, so I was not able to get eyes on areas where a threat may have been nearly as quickly as I could have had I gone ahead and freed up that hand. And after a while, I'm like going, okay, all right, Moses, it's more important to see first than be able to shoot first. And so I was like, okay, lesson learned. So my selection for flashlights, and like I said, these are just what I have. I would not say, hey, listeners, you need to go out and buy these lights. But, you know, my recommendation is consider getting a variation of these lights. Is for my weapon mount light. I just like that little TLR3. It's like an $80 or a $90 light. It works just fine. It's only about 120 lumens. But you can put it from firearm to firearm. You know, it's easily transferable to another firearm if it has anything like a Picatinny rail on it. So I like that. For my truck, I've got it's an older Army Tech light. I'm not even sure if they still make it, but it's like 700 lumens. And so I want a lot of light for my truck there. It doesn't have a strobe light, but I mean, there's a bunch of variations. Streamlight, Surefire, there's a lot of different versions of that that work just fine. But I want a lot of light there. I want 700 yeah. plus lumens. I want to be able to illuminate 100 yards if I need to.
Yeah.
If someone's coming up on me, I want to be able to kind of, you know, hey, get a quick light on them. You know, my thoughts are there is I do not want to just keep that light posted on them.
Right.
Okay. You know, I'll put that light on them and then I'll take them out of that straight beam because there's no reason to cause aggravation to people that are looking for trouble.
Yeah.
But if I think, that, oh my gosh, that person is doing something, you know, of concern, I've got that light and they cannot see where I am at that time. I've got that flashlight right in front of me. It's a Streamlight Pro-Tac 2AA. This is a neat little light. It's almost like a pin light.
Yeah.
It's 250 lumens and it actually has a strobe function.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's the light that I keep, by my bedside or in my shave kit when I travel. And then I have a friend and an instructor of mine named Andy Stanford who works for Surefire. And he was largely responsible in getting out this neat little light by Surefire called the Sidekick.
Oh, yeah.
And it's this little keychain light, and it's probably 1 inch wide by maybe 2.5 inches long. And you can put it on your keychain. And that thing will go all the way to 300 lumens.
Yeah. And, so, and it's rechargeable,
it's
too.
It's rechargeable.
Right?
Yeah. You put it in a little USB battery port, and it recharges. And so now there's no reason for me not to have a light on my person all the time. And you can never anticipate exactly what scenarios you might encounter. But, you know, just understand that, hey, you know what? We operate in darkness, you know, roughly half our life.
Yeah.
The criminal element uses darkness as concealment. And so having, you know, good white light and the skills and techniques to employ it properly, I think is just a wonderful thing for the concealed carrier.
Well, I like how it's when you're talking about for the home. I think that is a perfect application for a weapon-mounted light. If you're not on a as a police officer on a team or something like that. So that's good info. What about now? We talked a little bit too about last time about holsters.
Okay.
And I was telling you I got one that I really like, but the back of it's leather, front of it's kydex, and that leather flap over time starts folding down, and it's hard to reholster. So do you carry primarily, you said you have a Keeper's Concealment?
Keeper's Concealment and a JM Kydex. Both of those are just state-of-the-art as far as I'm concerned. I've got the Keeper's Concealment Errand holster for my Glock 43.
Mm-hmm. And that's an appendix?
That's appendix, and that is just awesome because I can take that whole pistol with the holster on it off my belt without, you know, taking my belt off.
Yeah.
And so if I need to go, you know, from an environment into a non-permissive environment in
We lost Stan, but that's okay. Keep going.
No, right. I'm actually here,
If I need
Mike.
To go from a permissive environment into a non-permissive environment, that allows me to take my whole handgun off in the holster without pulling the handgun off and put it into, you know, like a gun safe within the vehicle, secure it, and leave it. So I do like those holsters. By the same token, I also have a hip holster. Mm-hmm. I have a JM Kydex and a DSG Arms Kydex hip holster. I like Kydex simply because there's no break-in period associated with
it. Yeah, and it maintains fairly well over time. There are times, I think, where you can kind of reshape it, but
Sometimes they break. If you use them a lot, they'll break.
But, and then the tension
have to be adjusted and everything. But the thing I like about Kydex versus leather is that, and again, I've been doing this forever, is with all the quality leather holsters I've had in the past, there was a break-in period associated with it. And then you needed to be very careful to make sure that you had a holster, if it was leather, that the top of it would not collapse
right.
when the you know the handgun was out of it.
Yeah.
It's because then it's really difficult to get that handgun in the holster. Okay, well, just imagine you've just been in a high-stress situation, okay, and you can't get your handgun in the holster, and you're trying to get your other hand over there and thumb it open and everything, and then that's just a good time to, you know, shoot one of your fingers off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've seen people, you know— I've seen officers before physically not be able to holster because after a shooting incident because of the, you know, physiological effects that they go through and they just can't even reholster it. So that's especially, you know, either just being involved in something or having to deal with somebody with one hand and the other, it's nice to have a clear opening there and be able to reholster quickly.
Especially if you've got, you know, law enforcement responding and you need to get that gun in a you need to get that gun in a holster. But I do have hip holsters. They're Kydex also. I may have already mentioned that during this podcast. JM Kydex and DSG Arms, but there's a bunch of them. I need a little bit of a cant, about a 10 to 15 degree cant. And the other thing for a carry holster is you need to have the loops need to pull the handgun in tight to your body. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of guys with range holsters, you know, that it's just so obvious that they're printing. And the problem with that, even if you're in a state that, you know, from a regulatory perspective does not have a problem with it, that is also a that allows people to that you may not want to know that you have a gun and maybe they would like to have your gun. Or maybe they decide, okay, I've got to go ahead and take this guy anyway. I know he's armed because that's always been the advantage that we had as concealed carriers is we had the element of surprise. Well, now that's gone.
Right.
That's right.
So that ability to have a handgun, you know, carried in very tightly to your waistband, whether outside waistband or inside waistband.
Right.
And carried. And again, it needs about a 10 to 15 degree cant because, I mean, sometimes we wear, you know, suits and sport coats.
Right.
And, you know, you have to, you know, dress around it. So for my Glock 19, I have both a appendix holster and an outside the waistband holster on the hip. And for the 43, I have both of those plus a sticky holster. People, they sometimes say, well, you can use that as an inside the waistband holster. That's a terrible idea. Mm-hmm. That thing is just completely collapsible.
Yeah.
But it works great as a pocket carry for like a 365 or a Shield or Glock 43.
Now, before we talk about belts, we had one question that came in. Have you heard about a Zebra Light?
I have not.
Okay. We had somebody send in a direct question in reference to – so Steve wrote an article last week on our – or was it this week on the lights?
It was this week.
This week on the lights. And we had somebody ask about a Zebra Light. So I was going to ask you about
that. My answer would be is that – it's so hard for me to keep up with all that technology, and due to my budget, I just don't even go there and covet that stuff.
Yeah.
And so what I do is I try to find something that is very close to something that I use or something that someone that I respect and knows what they're doing uses. And so if it's a handheld light, the chances are that it's probably a pretty good light.
Mm-hmm.
The only issues with weapon-mounted lights is just that some of them can be kind of fragile and the mounting systems sometimes don't always work out real well. And so that would be my only, you know, cautions there. But there is just, there's a lot of fantastic, you know, flashlights coming out there right now. And I hope the SHOT Show, at the SHOT Show, that I'll see some. And if I do, I'll report on that. And I'm one of those people that said, hey, this is what I carry. It doesn't mean you have to carry, but it works for me. It's not necessarily a recommendation, but it's what I carry.
Just looking at the website on Zebra Lights, I mean, it looks like it looks like they have handheld and headlamps and range from $69 to $100 and some. They look like they're probably a pretty good light. It looks like they're pretty durable just from looking at them. But there's so many, you know, with the LED lights now, they have so many more options than when we were when Stan and I were on the street. Well, Stan had was on the street longer than I was, but so we've got. What about belts? What do you recommend on belts?
I'll tell you what. I'm going to go back to lights for just a moment before I'm 65 now. I lose my thoughts. your flashlight, in my opinion, needs to have a toggle switch. The toggle switch needs to be on the tail, okay, so you can work it with your thumb. So you basically grab it in a reverse grip. You put your thumb on the toggle switch. And the other thing is I like flashlights where I can just touch it, the light comes on and off, okay? I do not like flashlights that every time I touch it, the switch goes on, so I have to manually switch it off. I want to have to put more forceful action on that tail cap in order to engage that if I want to leave it engaged. But that's just stuff to consider. But again, it's got to have a tail cap at the end. And in my opinion, you got to be able to hit that intermittent light. Go ahead.
Now, does that have a, like if you double, does it go into a strobe function?
Yes, sir. Okay, so one hits me just a straight light, and two gives me a strobe function. And that strobe function does not disorient the recipient. They do not fall over in convulsions. They're not confused. But the cool thing about the strobe light, because I've been in a bunch of these force-on-force classes, is that when you're on the receiving end of that, if the person uses it in a manner that does not stay stationary, you cannot tell where they are. You cannot tell where they are. So I really like it. Okay.
And James Dole was our listener who asked that question.
So. Okay. It's a good question, James. As long as that particular light has those particular features, the other thing, you know, I might say is just you might check the reviews on it and make sure that someone doesn't have a lot of complaints about, you know, customer service. I don't know them, so I'm not saying anything negative. I always do a little bit of research, and then I make sure that there's got to be more than one or two comments, because all the people that typically – are positive about things like that don't say anything. It's only the people that. So I want to see you know, a good range of it, but I imagine that's probably a decent light.
Good. So belts? Belts is another thing that a lot of people overlook.
Okay. Belts are very, very important. One of the things that we always do before our classes is we send out a list of required equipment. We always tell them to bring a robust belt. And then invariably, I see concho belts. I see belts made out of horse hair. You know, so we basically, we keep extra belts just for our students. I wear, of course, just a good 1 1/4 inch thick leather belt on the that goes along with whatever suit or sport coat I'm wearing. If I'm going to carry under, you know, under a suit or a jacket, that's really not that critical to me. If I'm going to carry inside the waistband, I need to remember that it's probably going to require about 2 more inches of that belt to accommodate that, especially that with a mag pouch.
Right.
Appendix, right now I'm carrying the Graith Specialist. I'm hearing that there's a new belt coming out that I'm kind of excited about hearing about. I haven't actually seen it or gotten my eyes on it, but I kind of prefer these belts that kind of go along the old instructor belt type thing, where basically the belt is relatively long. It goes through, it loops through the two loops and then secured on Velcro coming back. So you may have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, and I got one for you. What size waist are you?
36.
Oh, 36, okay. I think, well, maybe 36. I'll have you try this because, yeah, I got one you can try here. Okay. But that's based on kind of similar to
belts are super, super, super important. And the other thing that I do is that I carry a fixed blade knife on my center line on the opposite side of my handgun. So I carry my handguns, probably would say that would be in the 1 o'clock position. I would carry a small center blade knife, I mean a fixed blade knife on the center line about the 11 o'clock position. And so I need a belt that accommodates both. And if you wear a leather belt that then where the remaining part of the belt then covers, you know, the knife, then that's going to create some problems for you. But I'm a, I think a belt and a holster and good magazine pouches are critical parts of your of your gear, much more so. And it really is disconcerting to me to see someone show up with a $1,200 pistol and a $10 a $10 holster, but we see it all the time.
Yeah, I'm sure. Now, what before we have to go, because we're going on almost an hour. What do you think about what's your position on lasers?
I tell you what, I actually believe in terms of the ability to shoot accurately at distances outside of 5 yards, a laser is possibly superior to even your red dot sights that you're now seeing on handguns.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen the red dot sights used by competitors for years and years, but most of those were affixed to the frame, and so the sight itself stayed stationary while the slide underneath cycled back and forth, but now we're seeing a lot of the red dot sights that are actually affixed to the slide itself, which means that they're going to, you know, reciprocate along with the slide. There's a learning curve associated with this. Again, I'd mentioned earlier podcast that I intend to train with Carl Wren this year. Carl is just a genius when it comes to this stuff. Grandmaster IPSC shooter, USPSA shooter, and he's done some in-depth research on the advantages and disadvantages associated with iron sights, lasers, and red dot sights.
Oh, yeah.
And it appears that the weapon-mounted laser and everything is actually an excellent tool for shooting, you know, outside of about 5 yards.
Yeah.
The only reason that it's not better at 5 yards is just it has no advantage over just iron sights at 5 yards just because of the position and the ability if you've got the proper index.
Right.
Red dot sights, I'm still – the jury's out on that for me on a defensive weapon. I know that I've gone places before where I've walked, you know – outside into a place and my glasses fogged up and during rain and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
But I would be I could very much see, you know, having a laser on my sight. Matter of fact, especially on a house gun.
You know,
I think Surefire makes a white light laser setup.
They do.
And
combo.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that's just like butter.
I've got one on my 43.
Yes.
Well, like 43 is for sure.
Yeah, in a home situation, and everything.
I don't use the. I have it switched on to where you turn it on. It's a light, just because I've found it personally hard to, and I tried one, but once you start firing, that thing is going all over the place, it's kind of distracting, I guess, more. I think it'd be something that if you trained with, I could definitely see the, the plus of it.
Well, and with a heavier weapon also,
right,
or heavier handgun, you know, I think you're going to probably see less jump and everything. Mm-hmm. And if you're still accustomed to using your sights and you're bringing them back down, you'll see that that laser. And so there's advantages to it. There's not enough in it for me right now to want to spend the money on it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Stan, we lost Stan, but Stan, we got you on speaker, I think, here. Do you have anything
to add? You
didn't
lose me. You got me. No, it's a great talk. We appreciate all of your time and your knowledge, you know, express it and help us out.
It's been great to have
you on. Much appreciated. Love you guys.
And we're going to have him on more in the future. And he's got some articles coming up, right? Some new ones?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, everybody be safe out there. And Steve, thanks again for coming in.
It's my pleasure.
And we'll see you soon. Take care, Stanley.
All right, bye, guys.